Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Diane Glancy. Diane Glancy is the author of more than 25 books of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and drama, including Pushing the Bear, a novel of the Trail of Tears, The Dream of a Broken Field, and American Gypsy, six Native American plays. Her newest book, Report to the Department of the Interior, was published by University of New Mexico Press. She is a professor emerita at McAllister College. Glancy served as a visiting professor of English at Azusa Pacific University from 2012 to 2014. Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, Jan.
It's such a pleasure to have you here from Kansas. So you're going to start with something from Dreams from an Open Field, is that correct?
I can.
Or from a broken field?
More than anything, I have longed for another. I remember it as a child. It has now been over six decades. I was born with a sense of abandonment I could not shake, though I lived in a house with two parents. I was on barren ground away from where I wanted to be, though I did not know where it was I wanted to be. I first heard of Jesus as a child because my parents took me to church. Probably even then I knew Christianity would be a solace, but it was later when marriage was difficult and I still had nowhere to go. I believed the gospel, though the emptiness was still with me. I have all things, I have nothing. That was the Apostle Paul who expounded the gospel, a man I never really liked. What an odd religion, the relationship with someone I can't see but believe is there. What an odd place to be a Christian in a secular, liberal college where I can count on my hand the other Christians, as far as I know anyway. Jesus would not have received tenure there. I have no visible proof that he is, other than what happened in my life, a steady, slow pace toward faith. Jesus lived a short life, half of what I have lived. I believe in him because of a terrible need to be whole. It is because I am incomplete in myself. I have believed. I have put weight on the words, the ear tests the word, Job 34:3. And though I felt Job's predicament from time to time, it was through the testing of words that I believe the Bible has the wholeness I sought. I had a longing for alignment to something, which turned out to be someone. He speaks through the words of the Bible. He is the word I chose to believe. Though disappointment and postponement of expectation is still with me, though I fit with no one, the resurrection is an idea that Christ was and is again, and that one day I would return to where I wanted to be. Several pages later comes the album. In my mother's album, there's a photograph of me standing in a neighbor's yard wearing a new dress and holding up on a hanger another one much like it. It must have been the beginning of a new school year. Why did I choose two dresses so much alike? I was drawn to clothes. I liked the sound of the word, clothes, clothes, C-L-O-S-E. What do you do when you go into a room and shut the door, close it, closet, put it in a clause, make a clause for it, hide it among other meanings, make it dependent. Later, my mother said she wished I'd had a sister. She must have sensed my aloneness, though I was with other clothes in the closet. I used to play paper dolls. I don't see them in stores so much anymore. When I was a girl, there were books and books of paper dolls. Paper dolls were awkward. I had a cardboard girl, then pages of clothes to cut out with tabs on the shoulders and at the sides. The cardboard girl had a stand, so I could stand her up. It was a plastic circle with grooves for slots for her cardboard feet, or there was a cardboard fold-out piece behind her that would hold her up. Then I placed the paper clothes on her, held on with tabs, if I didn't move her too suddenly, or play outside where the wind would carry her wardrobe away. What could I do with something so unbending, with clothes hanging on the front? What could I do without moving, or they would all tumble down? The necessity of disguise. You think you've got yourself covered, but your disguise is a paper dress held on by tabs over your shoulders and sides. Your whole back is open. You are cardboard, one-dimensional. Don't let anyone see you from the side or the back. Face them head on. No, it is paper hiding you from them. You are from a broken past. You are fragments held with tabs over your shoulders. You are nothing but a visage held by a presence. A clause is an exception. There was a lesson at Francis Willard Elementary School where I went. There was an agreement with a clause dependent on certain conditions. I could go if I was invisible. I could stay if I was quiet. I wore the childhood costume of scarlet fever, chicken pox, measles. I stood in space. I was closed in silence. I was pushed out of the house each morning. This is more than I thought I could ever say. Each word is a paper dress I wear on the island of these little paragraphs. If I had a sister, I would have eaten her. No, I would have torn her out of the book and made her wear clothes I didn't want to wear. She would not have had a choice. I don't know where these words come from, these little sharpnesses that stand side by side, these disconnectives. Clothing as landscape, clothing as geography, clothing as disguise and costume, the dialogues infested with Christianity. I took that thread of heritage from my father, of which I knew little except it was there. I expanded it, thought about it, stood apart from it. I don't have the heart to battle. I think I love war more than anything.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the writer Diane Glancy.
You know, Jan, I would love for you to read that poem about your mother and your dress. Because that's why I brought this book, because I had been reading your work this morning. In fact, I'll even find it for you. It is on page 7.
Okay, Diane Glancy putting me on the spot here. Something. But I'll do whatever Diane Glancy tells me to do.
Because I think for women, mothers and dress and clothing and all is very important.
And you were just reading about clothing, and we can talk about that. Okay. This is for Diane Glancy. My mother was a dress. For years, I was wearing her. She was cotton, her neck a blue V for her blue vagina that birthed 6 babies. She had a vanilla string around her waist, even though she was hooker red at heart, like me. I wore her for 2 years, along with a sister dress of deep cherry. When I went to meet her the first time at Catholic Social Services, I wore the cherry and she wore the blue vagina. We thought that genetics had made us go to Joseph P. Horn's to buy the V, but decided we both lived near the bloodless department store. After that, I took her off, stopped wearing her, didn't want her touching my body anymore. I prefer to think it's all animal. The way the V opens my neck to predators, the way she scissored her legs open to my father, the way the dress hugs my hips, then falls. Just like she said she hugged me once, before falling away, switching me out for sale.
Wonderful. I wish that was my poem.
Well, let's talk about your poems here, but thank you. So many things that you brought up right in that first bit of reading. If I had a sister, I would have eaten her, really jumped out at me. And I think you're so brave in your writing. Can you talk about where you get that bravery? You know, I think a lot of people might think if I had a sister, I would have eaten her, but they wouldn't write it down. So can you?
I don't know. I've always thought you were the one that was brave. When I was reading The Switching Yard, I was thinking, I wish I was brave enough to say things like that. Though I sort of do, but it's in my essay. I don't know where it came from. I just got tired of the silence. I got tired of being nice. I got tired of untruth. I got tired of the disguise, the living a script. And there was a real being moving inside of me that was never given privilege to speak because it's not nice. And because where I'm from in the middle of the country, you know, women are supposed to be nice.
So well, I think everywhere.
This too, if it doesn't come out right. I'm trying to put my thoughts into being here. But I just got angry at having to be who I was not. And I was married for many years, 19, and I finally found the courage to leave because it was not fitting. And after that, I went to Iowa where I met you in 1988, we decided was the year. And again, it just came from being suppressed. From an anger, enough.
And was it when you got to Iowa that you started to...
No, it was before.
Let loose?
Okay. When I went to Iowa, I had a lot of file boxes that I brought with me. I had written for years, but I never had an outlet for them. And minority literature was not in the early days. It was the late 80s when colleges and universities started wanting minority literature, women's voices. Mm-hmm. and I had quite a bit of backlog because I had been dealing with it for some time. And I'm very much an introvert, and I just couldn't get out there, and it took a long time. It's a long process, Lisa. Writing and finding a place for your manuscript and then standing up in public and reading from it. It didn't happen overnight. It took me a long time.
Well, thank God you did it. Over 25 books that you've written, which is amazing, and the books that we all need. But I want to ask you about this combination of things that you often do in your books, like that I love. Like, you do this thing where you combine some like poetic language, some facts, some documentation, some autobiography, and there is this sense of fragmentation which is beautiful in your work. And I think that that is something I've always been afraid to do, which is, you know, because, you know, you think, oh, it has to make sense, it has to be whole, it has to be this, blah blah blah. And when I read your work, I feel this release from that has to be, you know. So could you talk about that, the way that you write?
I think it takes many voices to tell a story, and any point in history has many truths, many sides to it. And so part of my work was to give voice to those who did not have a chance to speak. I do a lot of Native history, voices that have wanted to speak. And especially as I travel on the land and visit historical sites, some of them not well known, because I do a little bit of research, but the most of it is not known. So I drive to the place where whatever happened that I'm writing about, and I pick up voices from the elements, from the air, from the land, from the little research I've done, from my own inner life. I just have had a very fragmented life. I mean, The Dream of a Broken Field is the name of the book that I was reading from. And I think in a way it's the subconscious, you know, when you wake up from a dream, all these wonderful conflicting things come together. And to make use of those fragments and to put together my world that was so broken apart. And when I really look back, it was just an open space. I was born in Kansas City, and we would make trips down to my mother's parents. It was farm. There was the land, and there was a sky, and maybe a little thin fence between them. And a cow, one cow out there in the pasture. Just absolute barrenness, sparseness. They used to have a saying, what was it? We must be, I can't think of what, I put it all away. But it was just having the wind and the turmoil and all these wonderful facts and ideas. The imagination is just terrific. We live in a world that's so vivid. And putting all those conflicting things together. I've just enjoyed doing that. It's the way I think, I guess.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Could you read some more?
Yes. Getting back to mothers. This starts, that's the title, Mother. It's a capital M and then other in parentheses. My mother was the other in the house. She was something of which I was not part. I was left alone with her in the house until my father came home and my brother was born. A child is an island. A child is a moth. A child is a spot on a distant sea. My mother was in the house as I was, a dimmer light, an unwanted smut. I made up words for the land I inhabited. I found it moved like a floating island bumping against a continent that didn't want it bumping. I rode my island back to the sea, bypassing as it bypassed. What was it that was the connective? I was where I had to be when there was nowhere as yet to go, going and ungoing. My dreams always were of travel. To speak of a mother is to speak of my father's grandfather, who ran because he had to run to cover his tracks. Even his gravestone says he was born in Arkansas, but it was Indian territory. He lied and ran, as my mother wanted the same cut and run, but I was the moth that kept her in the house. I was the cement block that tried to drown her. She swept with a broom that was her tongue, her insistence on the mothership of which I was the dinghy with cords that could be cut. I was the object to which she objected. I take this language of words, though language at first is soundless. It is a longing for a connective, but it's separation that first rose across the sea. I am here, you are there. It is the first realization of motherness, a filament of sound called language, that could never breach the break. that took me to the shipwreck of my own motherness, where my own children found the same sea. Mother of dry grass, mother of flatlands, my mother of sharp boulders by the sea, mother of vast loneliness and disappointment, who thought she was escaping a farm, but ended up nonetheless stranded in a field. Forgive me for my attitude. I was a worse mother than she. My language was a suitcase. Forgive me, mother, for the ungraciousness of this written text. I am speaking to you as if I stood at your grave, which I have done. I know your sacrifice. I was what you didn't want to do, but did it nonetheless. You yourself were shipwrecked, marooned, stranded on an island you only wanted him to reach. What did you think when you married him? Idea and the actuality that surrounded that idea were different. The disappointment you received is your paycheck, recipient of undefined sadness that was the crop on the Kansas farm where you were raised. It sent you away on a vessel. Goodbye. I look back to your formidable shore that I would never reach, but took the broken boards and made a wooden shore that almost looked like land. So there again, I just read it. I look back to your formidable shore that I would never reach, but took the broken boards, you know, the broken pieces, the fragments that we were talking about coming from 100 different places, and made a wooden shore that almost looked like land. Mm-hmm. And I think that my writing is that shore that I have made. You know, it's a map, it's a shore, it's a fish trap, it's everything. I had only sparseness until I began to write, and then the sparseness became something edible.
Where did that word come from? I don't know, but I wish I could talk like that. I'm writing down what you're saying because it's all so great. And I'm like,
I'm going to give you this book if you don't have it. You may just
have it. I have it.
Okay.
Trust me.
See, you could have had a free book. But oh, no.
But, oh, yeah. I mean, when you, it's like you're just speaking in poetry or something. It's amazing. Yeah. My writing is that shore. My writing is that...
A wooden shore.
Yeah, a wooden shore.
I've had to make a real life out of... fragments out of things.
And I think a lot of women writers do that, and we both have had many women students who come to this with trepidation and and loss, and like, where do I start? And no, I can't really say that. And you're such a great model for that.
You know, you had a question last night. Somebody wanted to know how to write about their mother and pain. And afterwards, I was talking to her about it, and I said, because when you first write about your mother, there is such a sense of transgression.
Yes.
When you write about their private lives, their privateness, and it gets into pain and brokenness, and it's a taboo almost.
Absolutely.
And you just have to transgress. And I said, start writing. This is a transgression, but this is what I want to say. And then you just get into it.
Yeah, you said in that, what you just read, forgive me for my attitude, you know, it, within that piece, which I thought was amazing. you know, you're apologizing within the piece or asking forgiveness within it. And
I am laying her out flat.
Yeah, I mean, that's
that sense of transgression, that sense of, I really shouldn't be saying these things, because you respect your mother for what she did.
Well, I mean, not everyone does, but I think there's that cultural need to do that, and that's the right thing to do, we're taught. And
again, the script that we should
the
follow.
The script, absolutely. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about research, because... I know that for some people listening out there, some new writers, that it might, and for me, it would be really helpful to hear, you know, what you talked about, going to places and listening for voices. Mm-hmm. So if you're writing about a particular thing that happened in Native history, that you're talking about going to a place where something happened and just waiting, trying to feel the voices, hear the voices?
I don't think I could write if I did not travel to the place, because it is in travel that the voices come for me. About 2000, I knew that the bicentennial of the Lewis and Clark expedition was coming. So I went to the college library and I took out these massive volumes of Meriwether Lewis. And I knew that Sacagawea had traveled with them, but they hardly ever mentioned her in the journals. So what was it like to travel with 33 men? She had a baby on her back, and women were your community, and then all of a sudden she was separated from them. So I did the research. I listened to the journals on tape, and I had read them, and I charted my map following the Missouri River, the Columbia River, to the Oregon coast. And I didn't hear her voice at all, even at Fort Mandan, where she was from, where they picked her up. But I was at Wolf Point, Montana, and I saw a little sign, River Access. And so I drove down this winding road to the river. And I had a few of my notes on research, and I kind of baptized it. I washed some of the water, the river, over the manuscript, and I began to hear her voice. "You know you are nothing they want." That was the first line that came to me. Mm-hmm. And the rhythm of the rowing and the rhythm of that line. "They can look past you without thinking." I can't remember the rest of it. "They will change what you are forever, but you take them for buffalo robes." And that voice came out of my imagination. I don't believe in channeling. She was not there. In fact, someday I'm going to see her in the hereafter, and she's going to say it wasn't that way at all. But I could hear that rhythm. And for my book, Stoneheart, for the text, it was the voice that fit. So you do your research, and when it gets very thin, you travel to the place where the history happened. You trust your imagination in conjunction with the little research that you have, and you just begin. I remember having a radio interview with some women from the Mandan village in Montana, and they believed that she lived to be an old woman and died on Wind River. But according to Lewis and Clark, she died as a young woman, and I think she probably did. So we're having this knockdown fight on the radio. We just couldn't stop. It kept getting worse, you know, because there are many truths to history. There are many voices in history. She died as a young woman. No, she didn't. So... And then I went on to the Oregon coast. They have historical stops along the way. And because I asked permission of the land, because I've done this for so many years, because I know that kind of research, you develop it. And so whatever I have written, I always go to the place. Mm-hmm. And there's a visage or an energy field or something that's hard to explain that is left behind, and I pick it up. Because I think... these voices want to be told. I think they want to be heard. I think there's a part of history that has been long ignored, and I like those parts of history.
Well, I'm getting chills listening to you. So, I mean, I think the voices are so real, and you say you don't believe in channeling. Well, maybe it's not channeling, but it's something.
I know it is something. I think we carry racial memories. I think we know a lot more than we know. And I think it works in the subconscious. Sometimes when I'm working on a book, I wake up in the morning with a feeling of where I should go, a further development. I think women have a special memory that we share a community of voices, and certainly race and place. There's just a lot more going on. The land certainly has memory, the body of the land, the map of the land. One reason I love to travel out in the West across these interstates, because I've done enough research, they began as migration trails for the buffalo, for animals. And the land surveyors and the mail routes and the settlers just followed those grooves in the land that the Indians also walked. And the interstates, I'm getting chills too, and the interstates were first, and the little tiny highways were first laid down over those trails, and then the interstates. So when you're traveling along I-80, I-70, I-30, 20, whatever, you are traveling back through a couple of centuries and through many travels.
Wow.
And those voices are there.
Wow, that's amazing. So, wow.
And because creativity is like a magnet, I think things click to it that wouldn't otherwise. And I have to travel alone, too. See, if you and I were together,
too.
We would talk, have a good time.
It'd be fun, though.
I would miss all of this. I have to be alone. And also, when you travel for several days by yourself, you get into that groove and you go very deep into yourself. Yeah. And there's a depression, a sadness, an aloneness, And that's also where those voices are. In fact, somewhere in here I've written about that too. Mm-hmm. And so you really are on a mission, a special vision quest in a way, though I don't do vision quest, but my travel alone is certainly that.
That's right. Could you read a little more for us?
It seems to me there are mark lines across the earth, something like fault lines that are not fractures, but continuances. They are bindings that hold together. They are road lines that serve as preservation of what already has passed and disappeared. Yet the relics are here, invisible markings like longitude and latitude that travel the earth, marking one thing to another in a peripheral way. Usually not direct sight, but off there in the field I pass are the runnings to other places. Preservations that leave minimal evidence of what can be surmised or guessed at. The mark lines are the voices of the earth, the roadways of landscape, the through lines of its transcendency, a land script that marks the land. They are like the invisible lines that holds the constellations into the figures they are called by. Sometimes I think they are ball lines, B-A-W-L. When I feel sorrow transversing the atmosphere, those bindings around the earth always evident in travel. Over a 2009 spring break from school, I drove 445 miles from Gambier, Ohio to Boone, North Carolina. I gave a talk at Appalachian State University and went to bed. I woke around 2 a.m. to start on the 924-mile journey to Kansas City, where I live most of the time and where I have grandchildren. When I wake with the road calling, I go. I was going to drive halfway, maybe over halfway, but when I called my daughter, the children had a program at school that evening to which I was invited. I kept going. I arrived in Kansas City just after 5 p.m., 15 hours of passing through space just above the road. Sometimes when traveling to one place, another place comes through. Sometimes there is an overlay of voices from other times. Voices carry the earth. Therefore, the land is an act of memory. 2 days after my long journey of returning to Kansas City for spring break, I had a trip to read from my work at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. I watched the weather for another blizzard up there, but it looked clear for a few days. I looked online at airfares, but travel to a place off the usual travel lanes was expensive, $600 to $1,000. I decided to drive. I knew the air crossed above me with planes. Just look at the vapor trails. Each day there is a network of planes crossing north, south, east, west, northeast, southeast, northwest, southwest, and crosswise across the sky along their set routes. They often follow the interstates or use the highways for navigation. The blots of cities are markers, too. I imagine the diagonal lines, lines circling back upon themselves. All of them still there in the unrecognizable forms, destinations toward which the highways are headed, toward which they connect in an overall movement that has nothing to do with destination, but in the movement itself. The journey is the process of journey, the gathering of moth wings until one can fly.
The writing of Diane Glancy. Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.